Hello. Welcome to this program titled Early Risk of Mortality After Revascularization, What Do We Need to Do? I'm Rahul Doshi from the University of California in Irvine, and I'm serving as moderator of the program. I'm an electrophysiologist, and we make some introductions of our very distinguished panel, but a few introductory comments. Together with bypass surgery, the widespread adoption of percutaneous coronary intervention has allowed for tremendous improvement in the management of acute myocardial infarction. However, despite this, the risk of arrhythmic death, and something near and dear to my heart, of course, is highest shortly after myocardial infarction. So identification of those patients at highest risk and the use of appropriate therapy can save lives. But considerable controversy exists in this setting. Specifically, what should we do in this period post-MI, post-revascularization. So today we'll examine those risks. We'll evaluate measures to prevent sudden cardiac death in patients with compromised left ventricular ejection fractions after surgical and or percutaneous revascularization. So with me, I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Mina Chung from the Cleveland Clinic, who of course is also an electrophysiologist. Dr. David Kanzari from the Piedmont Heart Institute in Atlanta, Georgia, who is an interventionalist, and Dr. Eric Rosselli from the Cleveland Clinic as well, who is a cardiothoracic surgeon. So they will be able to offer their unique perspectives. And so welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ron.
And thanks for being here. So I wonder if we could start off specifically addressing the risk of sudden cardiac death after myocardial infarction. There's a numerous amount of data sets and evaluations specifically looking at this issue. And I wondered if, Dave, you could address some of the data from Valiant or some of the other data sets post-myocardial infarction.
Sure. Well, I think to begin with, this is a challenge that affects all of us as cardiovascular practitioners, independent of our disciplines. And in particular, there's a remarkable consistency across the data that would really highlight the fact that post-MI patients, and especially those with left ventricular dysfunction, are at especially high risk for sudden death. And that's a risk that sudden cardiac arrest risk is one that really never mitigates over time. If we follow these patients over a long term, the event rates never really converge to those individuals who have preserved ventricular function. But this risk is especially high within the first 30 days, and it especially is high even extending on a little bit further into the first 90 days. We know this from a succession of trials, from more dated studies like the Cadillac trial to even more recent observations like the ACC-NCDR registry following myocardial infarction, that the presence of LV dysfunction post-MI portends a risk of mortality even at 90 days that may exceed 11%, maybe as high as 30% in selected patient cohorts. Valiant, as you referenced, highlighted the fact that the risk of sudden death in that early 90-day period was at least 2 to 2.5-fold higher compared with other individuals with preserved ventricular function. And what's also striking to me with regard to the uncertainty of the timing of these events, the unpredictability of them, is that over 80% of these events are going to occur after hospital discharge, too. So in some ways, although we can develop risk models that we can discuss, although we can quantify that risk numerically for mortality in that early phase, it probably addresses more questions than answers that we have.
So I would ask you then specifically as an interventionalist, you mentioned especially these very high event rates after ST elevation myocardial infarction of the 32% number you were referencing.
Yep.
But certainly low ejection fractions in this post-myocardial infarction, post-PCI setting, these patients are at high risk. Are there any unique challenges from your standpoint that you think we need to overcome just clinically? For example, should these patients be encouraged to have an automated external defibrillator at home? That's been addressed in a clinical trial, the HAT trial. Or are there any other particular recommendations that you all are looking at?
Also being a critical care physician, too, I think one of the challenges or dilemmas, and we'll have Eric speak to this, too, is that, number one, while we may feel reassured that we do primary PCI for these patients and we revascularize them, number one, I'm humbled by the fact that revascularization doesn't necessarily protect against or mitigate against that risk. Number two, many of these people after primary PCI for ST elevation MI have other residual disease. So we have this kind of staging period where there's still residual disease that portends even further risk for these patients. Are these people at greater risk than someone who had single vessel disease that was revascularized? But altogether, I think for me the biggest challenge right now is the unpredictability of recovery of LV function. So as we all experience, we have individuals post-MI who may be awaiting bypass surgery, who may be awaiting stage revascularization, who may have been revascularized. And the big challenge is, can we identify those individuals whose LV dysfunction is going to improve, remodel, supersede an ejection fraction of 35-40%? We just don't know.
Right. So that's a perfect segue. Dr. Roselli, I wonder if you could give us your thoughts from the surgical standpoint, just following these patients clinically after bypass.
Sure. I mean, first of all, it is great to be on this multidisciplinary panel because you're right, it is a common problem for all of us. Specifically in the surgery patients that we see who often have multivessel disease, and we may get to them in a period after their delayed fashion after their acute MI. The fundamental problem with the patients we see, and it's true preoperatively and postoperatively, is we don't know how any one specific patient is going to respond to that revascularization, or any territory of myocardium is going to respond to revascularization. So one of the things we do before we operate on folks is we do a lot of viability studies in these folks with low EF. And the problem is, and we've seen this from the Stitch trial analysis, is that it's not that predictive of exactly how these patients are going to respond. It doesn't give us the data that we really want to know. What it does do, however, doing viability studies, is give us a sense of the safety of revascularizing patients. So in other words, we know that if a patient has a certain amount of scar burden in an area that we plan to revascularize, it's probably not safe to go ahead with that revascularization, which we should think about another line of therapy. But we can get them through bypass surgery for multivessel disease if they have some viable myocardium in the areas that we want to revascularize, because we know that doing so prolongs survival, takes care of angina. But we don't know that we're going to make their myocardium work better. We don't know that we're going to improve their ejection fraction. And so we don't know necessarily whether we're going to eliminate that sudden cardiac death risk. And even in the postoperative period, when we have patients that we're more worried about, we can't predict exactly which one is the patient who we're going to send home and is going to have sudden cardiac death. So we have a need in all of us, all this group of patients, we have a need to understand these patients better and exactly what's happening to them. Or we have a need maybe to protect them better. And so that's where this discussion of the, you know, WCD, the wearable defibrillator, comes into place. Or when is the right time to get a defibrillator in these patients? Is 90 days, it seems in some patients like a really scary period of time.
Right. So this is, obviously, this is, as an electrophysiologist, we have very conflicting sort of viewpoints, and we have definitely conflicting data sets. We know there's a very high-risk population that exists post-myocardial infarction, post-revascularization, whether it's with percutaneous intervention or bypass surgery. We have these imposed waiting periods, the 40 days post-myocardial infarction, the 90 days post-revascularization, and this is based upon clinical trials. And in fact, of course, Dynamite was a negative clinical trial looking at the early adoption of an implantable cardiodefibrillator, though it did dramatically reduce arrhythmic death. So is this an issue with competing mortalities when the non-arrhythmic death rates were higher in the ICD arm in Dynamite as well as in IRIS? I think there are other unique challenges that bring up the issue of the wearable cardiodefibrillator. I mentioned the HAT trial earlier, which was a negative trial using automated external defibrillators, which is nice if you think that all these events are happening at home after discharge. But it's not so nice if they're not witnessed or they happen during sleep, where you're not necessarily going to have that type of resuscitation.
See, Rahul, you bring up a very good point, though, that maybe not all of these individuals that we're describing mm-hmm. are going to merit an early ICD implantation if it were available to them, or even a wearable defibrillator. But they all should be screened for such, right? And there are some particular patients, when we talk about trials like DYNAMITE being a negative study overall, really maybe negative in mortality because there are other, as you say, competing factors of renal failure, of infection and other issues in a very sick population post-MI who are going to have mortality. But still at least more than half, maybe perhaps 60% of the mortality events are sudden death. And trials like that did actually show an arrhythmic, a reduction in arrhythmic-mediated death, too. So perhaps that's maybe the element for the art of medicine rather than the science, that we need to have better predictive models of identifying who's really going to be at risk for sudden death and who would benefit from early intervention versus just the broader population itself of people post-MI.
We saw the same thing in folks who had defibrillators after CABG, too. I mean, we go back to the 90s in the CABG patch trial, negative study, but a 45% reduction in arrhythmia deaths when you do a focused a cause of death analysis. So it's all supporting
with
that.
A very difficult surgery.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, that was a very that was an epicardial defibrillator that was put in very early generation. So theoretically, morbidity and mortality rates after defibrillator implantation transvenously should be much lower today than it was back then. And the difference, I think, between a post-MI population and a revasc population is that we actually do have IRIS and DYNAMITE data looking at defibrillator versus no defibrillator implantation within the first 30, 40 days, whereas actually we don't really have that data with modern-day defibrillators for a post-revascularization population. People have tried to look at the randomized clinical trials, the primary prevention trials of defibrillators, and most of those primary prevention trials excluded people within the first 2 to 3 months after revascularization. And the sub-studies that have tried to look at early benefit of mortality, even those, you know, they're starting at 6 months. So we really haven't looked at the very early mortality within the first 3 months.
Wonderful. So that's so obviously this is a very complex issue, and I think there's a great deal of controversies here. And so maybe that's the perfect segue to speak about, well, we have to identify a risk in these patients, but maybe we shouldn't be committing them to an implantable defibrillator. And I think that's where, Mina, some of your data that if you could show us related to the wearable cardioverter defibrillator comes into play.
Sure. So, thanks. So, as you know the implantable defibrillators for primary prevention of sudden cardiac death has been shown to improve survival in patients with ejection fraction less than or equal to 35%. But they're only reimbursed when they're implanted 3 months after revascularization or 40 days after MI or 3 months after newly diagnosed cardiomyopathy. But if you look at event curves in many of these conditions, mortality risk is usually much higher early after cardiac events, including after MI or cardiac revascularization. So if you look at this large registry from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, Adult Cardiac Surgery Database, and the ASSERT study, I looked at 300,000 or so primary CABG patients over age 65 linked to the CMS databases. And you can see that there's kind of an early mortality risk. If you look at the survival curves, it's kind of a dual phase mortality curve. And if you look at patients who have an ejection fraction less than 30% in that cohort, it's even more marked. So this early phase is actually within the first 3 to 6 months. And that also is seen in the NCDR CATH PCI registry, perhaps even more markedly. So they divided patients into those who had STEMI and those who did not have STEMI. And again, you know, this registry had over 300,000 patients in it. And with or without STEMI, you see this marked high mortality that's very early on, again, within the first 3 to 6 months. That's particularly marked if you look at the population with low ejection fraction, and they used a cut point of 3%. So we wanted to look at this. For years, I've been kind of intrigued by the mortality curves we see after CABG. And that when MUST and MADIT first came out and they had excluded the first 3 months, you know, I'd look at our mortality curves and there was a little bit of a dip early on. So we decided that we would look at our revascularization population at the Cleveland Clinic who did not have were not discharged with a defibrillator or a wearable defibrillator, and compare those patients with ejection fraction less than or equal to 35% to patients who were in a national registry of WCD users who had their WCD put on because they were being discharged from PCI or CABG and had an ejection fraction less than or equal to 35%. So if you look at that data, we had about 4,900 patients. And if you look at PCI plus CABG patients shown in the red, you see this early mortality that I was mentioning. That in the inset of the figure, you see an instantaneous hazard curve, and it shows that there's very early instantaneous hazard risk, or early hazard risk. And if you look at the blue curve for the National Registry of WCD users, you don't really see that early hazard, or it's less marked. And if you break this down into looking at the survival early, like in the first 90 days, you see that it's significantly different. And then if you look at after 90 days, the curves still split a little bit. So there's some potential early benefit. Now, this was not randomized, but it's a comparison here. And Eric, you were also on the paper, and we also looked at broke it down by CABG and PCI.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the type of revascularization didn't seem to matter as much. So when we look at the curves we see here, again, we see an early hazard risk shown both in the inset, and you can see by the big dip in the red curve on this figure. But the late hazard phase doesn't seem to be that impressive. The curves flatten out later on. So there is an early separation. And when we look at these folks where now a more focused view on the curve on the left where the x-axis is months, so we look at the first 90 days, we see that there is a separation between those with and without the wearable defibrillator, such that the mortality was only 2% in that group as compared to 7%, and that was significantly different. Beyond 90 days, you take out the folks who didn't survive the first 90 days, and again, we still see this separation in the curves. So I think that this is definitely telling us something about these patients. There certainly are limitations to the to where the data came from, but it's a big study, and it's consistent across all these analyses.
So, Eric, I'll ask you about, and Mina, too, your thoughts on this, that as we introduced this topic, we felt like revascularization, interestingly, didn't protect against an arrhythmic event. And if anything, we see that post-revascularization, there is this maybe early phase where patients are at risk for greater events as well, and perhaps this is an opportunity here for early intervention or early screening for these type of people. What is it, though, Eric? I'll ask you as someone else who revascularizes. What is it? Is it the inflammation post-operative that's contributing? It's not necessarily that, because it happens with PCI as well.
True. Well, what we're showing is death.
Yeah,
you know, and these are sick people, and so certainly there is. You would imagine there's more of an inflammatory burden on the patient who undergoes surgery. But when we look at these next set of slides that shows PCI, we see that the early hazard risk is even higher. So it's not just the type of procedure, and it's not just what we're doing to them. Maybe, though, we see this greater separation in the early hazard risk in the PCI patients because we have more patients having acute MIs.
Yeah.
So, again, well, there's your inflammation hypothesis, you know.
And before we go to the PCI data, too, I'll ask you about this, Mina, is that you show this or suggest this enduring benefit even after the 90-day period or the period of a wearable defibrillator. Is that just a a function of us following these patients more carefully, or is it they all then transition over to an ICD? What's the mechanism there?
It could be, because the split, though, is more marked early on.
Yeah.
And that was the period that they wore a WCD. But the splitting of the curve after 90 days is hard to explain, but it's more marked in the PCI cohort. So it's hard to know if maybe that cohort isn't getting as much follow-up to reassess their LV function. I think after CABG, you know, they're going to come back for their follow-up. After PCI, if we think, oh, we've opened the artery and you're done, you know, you're good, but you may not be good if your ejection fraction is still low.
I think that's the plug that everyone should see an electrophysiologist after their revascularization.
More job security.
More job security for us, that's right. Well, it's interesting. I mean, so you would hope, and I think this is borne out in the data sets as well, that these patients were more likely to receive an implantable cardioverter defibrillator in having the vest. But I'm interested and wondered, Mina, if you could specifically address the event rates with the wearable cardioverter defibrillator. And is that the whole story for why these dramatic differences in that 90-day period where they're wearing the vest?
It's not. It doesn't explain everything. There's a several percent difference in their mortality rates in the first 90 days, and the median duration of or mean or median duration of use of the WCD was 3 months or less. And there was there were events that happened in about 1.3% of the patients. So it doesn't explain the entire benefit. But it's possible that they could have gotten attention earlier, maybe moved on to a defibrillator. We know that almost a third of the WCD population ended up getting defibrillators, and we don't have that number for the no WCD group.
Right.
So it's possible that they got better follow-up, and they potentially could have had arrhythmic symptoms or AFib or warnings from the defibrillator was about to go off, and that's not accounted for by the actual shocks that were delivered by the WCD.
Mina, I'm always impressed about the lack of a compliance and adherence to medical therapy after revascularization, after acute myocardial infarction. We have some studies suggesting that discontinuation of antiplatelet therapy may exceed 10%, beta blockers, other medications similarly. Here, what struck me about wearable defibrillator data is that maybe it's a part of natural selection, but for patients who wear it for a short period of time, they don't typically wear it throughout much of the day. But for people who adhere to it longer term, the compliance or adherence kind of tracks more throughout the 24-hour period. Did you see this? Have you tracked compliance in your study as well?
Not in this study, but in an earlier study off the whole WCD database we did. So there was actually pretty good compliance in that. Something like over 90%, 85-90% wore the WCD for more than half the time. And, so the median use was actually not as low as what you would think.
Yeah.
So they are using it, but it also could potentially make them, seek follow-up and, should I continue to wear this or should I not continue to wear this? They'll want to know that.
Yeah.
I mean, you could probably guess that someone who has to wear that thing is being constantly reminded to be compliant with all of their care, I mean,
that's a good point.
The vest sort of scares them into being compliant with everything.
So, Raul, I'll ask you too. Knowing that this is very provocative data, I think it's very supportive of maybe our intuitive risk that we've observed for these people. Do we need randomized trials in this situation, or is this almost bordering on unethical that we should do this? Or what are the situations where we might find an opportunity for randomized trials based on DYNAMITE and studies that you've referenced already?
It's a great question, and there is an ongoing prospective clinical trial that's larger, that's similar to DYNAMITE, called the DAPA trial, and it's a larger cohort, and it's a little bit different. It's 30 to 60 days post, and I think the ejection fraction cutoff, I believe, is 40%. And that would be interesting data if you could demonstrate a total mortality benefit, and then we could make further distinctions based upon what we think are comorbidities, whether the patient should have an implantable device or be bridged to see if they survive or they're capable of survival for non-sudden cardiac death reasons. I think this data is still, though, hypothesis generating. It's still interesting that the whole story is not just the arrhythmic survival. Is this just a function of good follow-up plus the added benefit of clear event rates that are real in this high-risk population? And so I would turn around and ask all of you, how are you then today, based upon the data we have? And I think we have fairly good data suggesting who's at high risk. So are all of you taking data from, let's say, whether it's from Cadillac or from Valiant or whatever else, risk stratifying your patients, taking all the low EF patients, they're older, they have diabetes, they have renal insufficiency, they weren't completely revascularized, and making a decision to, okay, you're a low ejection fraction patient, you're going to get a WCD, you're not a high-risk patient, we'll stratify you differently. Is it different in the circulation? You as an interventionalist, anterior MI versus not? So I'll flip it right back to you guys.
You go first, Eric.
Certainly there are patients where, where we're more worried about based on their anatomy, their burden of disease, and the other other comorbidities that we know put them at high risk. But we don't have a dedicated way to assess that. It's still the art, as you described earlier.
I think for myself, it's the first step is in screening these patients. I think as an interventional cardiologist, we need to take some responsibility as the first point of contact for many of these people coming into the hospital for their primary PCI event at initiating the screening process and then working with our colleagues, our consultants, electrophysiologists as well. But there's this bridge of window here where the patient then gets discharged to home, a fairly uneventful course. And then while they're waiting to go see Mina or you, Rahul, there some adverse event occurs. And so there are predictive models, like from Cadillac, that we can apply to identify who's going to be at greater risk, people who are elderly, people who have renal impairment. But by far the greatest predictor that's going to drive those risk models is LV dysfunction. So again, I would go back to saying for myself, like Eric, I don't know exactly who's going to have that event with LV dysfunction. We know the risk is considerably higher for them. And not everybody maybe needs to have a wearable defibrillator or go on to an ICD implantation. But to screen them, to screen all of them, really I think should be a quality core measure in our hospitals.
That's great. Mina, any comments?
Well, often we don't see them. After PCI, they get discharged very soon after that, and if they're we see the post CABG patients if they're having non-sustained ventricular tachycardia and then or some worrisome arrhythmic event, and so we don't actually, as an electrophysiologist, we don't have a chance to intervene prior to discharge except in those very high risk patients. So it's actually the surgeons and the interventionalists mm-hmm. who are the first line. I agree with you.
We are a little bit limited, though, sometimes. Yeah. We call you to see a patient who, maybe hasn't had an arrhythmic event, but they haven't, especially low EF, and we get them plugged into the system, but then we have to wait.
That's right. And so that's where I think it's a change that this data, I think, are very provocative, that we have to think about whether or not we really should be protecting them in this first 3 months. And if you're very worried about them, a bridge is reasonable. I'm also struck by, I try to do a literature search in terms of, well, how many of these patients with LVEF less than 35% actually make it to over 35%, by 3 months. There are very little, there's very little data out there.
And
it's
like
between a quarter to three quarters, and a couple papers. And so you can't really predict. And, with that, then you don't want to go and slap in a defibrillator into everybody, but perhaps a wearable defibrillator is a good bridge. But I'd love to see a randomized trial.
I would agree.
There is a randomized trial going on post MI Fest, so I'm really interested in the outcome of that.
And we haven't even addressed some of the other issues, such as we're fixated seemingly after their intervention, their bypass or their percutaneous intervention. Well, what about the patients that are waiting for that revascularization who are at high risk, most CABG still being elective. A staged PCI would be another good example in a high risk population. I think this has been a great discussion, and I think it does illustrate a lot of the both the controversies, but I do think we are speaking about a very high-risk population that we do need to do something about, whatever that ends up being. Any final thoughts as far as any challenges with this therapy?
For myself, I would only just highlight that there's this large unpredictability that I think you really well characterized of who's going to improve and who doesn't. And this is such a common issue for all of us across our disciplines that screening really is probably the first step for us to begin.
That's great. So with that, of course, Eric, David, and Mina, thank you very much for participating on the panel.
Thank you.
This has been a great amount of data that you've shared with everybody. And I'd like to, of course, thank all of you for participating in this activity. And, of course, to proceed to the CME post-test, you have to click the Earn CME Credit link on this page. And, again, thanks to everyone.